then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Wanderers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 17th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I'm going to play something for you now. It's short, and so I won't count it as one of the music breaks for this episode. No idea who this is. I looked it up on YouTube, and I can't find a name attached to it.
Was driving around in old Mexico. I got lost, I didn't know which way to go. I was confused, it was late and I was in a fog. I ran over the Taco Bell dog. I felt that smush and I said, oh mama, my lowrider crushed that little chihuahua. I prayed for forgiveness in a synagogue. I ran over the Taco Bell dog. If I am caught, they will put me in a cell with 20 locks. Unless I can pin it on Jack in the Box. I'll be whipped, then beaten, and then I'll be flogged. I ran over the Taco Bell dog. His last words were, yo quiero el médico. I flattened that pup, to hell I will go. I should have skipped driving and gone for a jog. I ran over the Taco Bell dog. I ran over the Taco Bell dog. I ran over the Taco Bell.
It's going to be at least a week before I can get that tune out of my head. I don't even know if that stupid Taco Bell Chihuahua is still on television. I haven't had a TV in years. But I do remember that every time one of those stupid ads came on, I always got this urge to make it go splat with a baseball bat. Now, you know how the Chihuahua breed came about, don't you? Indians ate dog. And the Aztecs bred chihuahuas and raised them for food, like we raise chickens. That's why they get fat so easily. They were bred that way. Okay, a few general comments on current events. First off, I want to somewhat amplify on a Donald Trump commentary that I made on the Thought Crime blog last week. I've gotten some emails from some of our listeners who have pretty clearly drunk the Donald Trump Kool-Aid, and that's fine with me, actually. Unlike the Jim Jones variety, Trump's Kool-Aid isn't likely to be fatal. Those of you who can remember past episodes of Radio Free Northwest and also some of my writings will recall that I actually predicted that at some point in the future, some white guy with a nice suit and a $10,000 capped tooth smile and a blow-dried hairdo bearing a remarkable resemblance to a televangelist was going to arise from the world of celebrity and for a while come on as the man on the white horse and the white Martin Luther King, so to speak, out of motivations of ego or money or power craving, because he would be the first to figure out that white people will adore him if he says out loud what we are all thinking in our hearts and minds, and if he promises a quick fix, i.e. all you have to do to make everything as it was is go into the little booth and pull my lever and send money and I will make it all go away, and you can plop back down on the couch, crack a cold one, and turn on Dancing with the Stars again. No kidding. I have been anticipating something like this for years, and maybe it's good that we now have a chance to get the man on a white horse syndrome out of our systems. So, for the record, if you guys want to engage in some recreation by playing around with the Donald Trump thing, by wearing his campaign buttons and bumper stickers, and by using him to play pranks and piss off the lefty libs and the beaners in a more or less safe way, that's fine with me. I couldn't stop you anyway. One of the things I've found down through the years is it's impossible to keep the kids' noses to the grindstone in their school books and keep them looking at the algebra on the blackboard when the circus is in town, parading down the street outside with calliopes and elephants and clowns, with bells and whistles and balloons and money raining down from the sky like confetti, as Americans expect and demand. Now, that's happened before, even in our own wee little movement. Some of you may remember from back around 1999 that shooting star Wolfgang Hawk and his Knights of Freedom, which was the first virtual racist party to exist solely on the internet, and how everybody ran to him like lemmings. Of course, later he turned out to be a Jew named Andrew Greenbaum, but we won't rehash that particular excruciating embarrassment yet again, since we have so many more recent ones to live down. Trump is a much smoother article, and I actually think he will probably end up doing some long-term good for our cause by way of unintended consequences. So, by all means, guys, keep up with him and cheer him on and wear his doodads in the face of all the scum, and have a blast. I don't mind. This is something that is historically inevitable, and it has to happen, just as it's inevitable that we will eventually be disillusioned, since nothing of any racial value can ever come out of the existing liberal democratic system. Guys, cheer for Trump, laugh with him, post his stuff on the net, and if it gets that far, vote for him. I might do so myself, just to cock a snook at Salon Magazine. And I would actually like to see Trump win just to hear those assholes and the assholes at Huffington Post and Politico scream and scream and scream. I love seeing and hearing lefty libs having paranoid hysterics. Just do not expect him to be the Republican nominee. The rhinos will find a way to stop him, even if it's through the sudden appearance in a crowd of a quote-unquote crazed loner with a pistol in his hand, just like they did to George Wallace and like they tried to do to Ronald Reagan. And at some point, you must understand that you are going to be devastated when you are bitterly and terribly betrayed by something that Trump says or does. When he does come crashing down, it will not be enough for Trump to merely bow out after having raised this kind of ruction. They're going to carry grudges. He will have to do what the Jews call making teshuvah, ritual humiliation and groveling. Also, a quiet word of warning, and I'm not just talking about his strong Jewish ties. We all know about those. You will note that Trump has been very, very quiet on the nigger question. And there is a reason for that, possibly a calculated reason on his part. Now, there was a poll out today that claims Trump is supported by 25% of the African-American vote. And I have to say that if it's accurate, that is, in fact, an incredible accomplishment, since black votes for the Democrats have been a complete lock for the past three generations on the 98 or 99% level. Apparently, some of the niggas are smart enough to realize that this flood of third-world immigration into this country is very bad for them. Even more so in the long run than for us. They understand that their share of the racial spoils system has been getting smaller every year for a generation, and that these third worlders, when they become a majority and get the real power, aren't going to put up with their bullshit. Especially the Asians. Can you imagine the Chinese or the Mexicans putting up with Black Lives Matter? It is just possible that Trump may have found some way at long last to pry a significant percentage of nigger votes away from the Democrats, trading on black people's instinctive fear of brown people, whom they understand they can't mau-mau, and who are just as primitive and violent as they are, and a lot smarter than they are. And if he can convince the Republican Party shakers and movers that's the case, they might just decide not just to let him live, but maybe even back him. And that means that before this goes on too much longer, Trump is going to have to be pandering to the primates like nobody's business. Guys, have a fling with Donald Trump if you want. but you need to understand that he is not one of us. He has never been one of us. His whole life shows that his allegiance is to the almighty dollar even more so than to his own massive ego, and he will betray you. So long as you go into it with your eyes open, fine. Have fun. And so long as you don't entertain any illusions about the final result, yeah, we can have a lot of fun with this. Got an email from one of our several Jasons, this one in Nashville, Tennessee. Dear Miss Covington, how can I learn about the Jewish mindset? I don't just mean from all the standard stuff like protocols of the Elders of Zion, but from their own mouths, so to speak. Good question, Jason. I sometimes get requests for a good basic primer to the Jewish question, preferably a website, of course, and there's a lot of those. The book on the subject for the American reader is Commander Rockwell's White Power, but I think I understand what Jason is asking here. Where can you learn about the Jews from the horse's mouth, so to speak, or possibly horse's ass would be a better description? That's a hard one, because I have spent most of my adult life reading all kinds of stuff about the Jews, both openly anti-stuff like Henry Ford's International Jew and Frank Britton's Behind Communism, and their own material of every stripe, Zionist, communist, pornographic. There's a lot to choose from, but some people might not find them as illuminating as I did. Now, I would recommend a novel by Philip Roth called Portnoy's Complaint, but I can't do so in all honesty, because I've never been able to read the whole thing. No kidding. I first attempted it in high school, for some reason, and ever since then, I have tried it again every 4 or 5 years or so, and honest to God, guys, I can't finish it. It makes me physically ill. I mean, it nauseates me for real. I think I got almost halfway once many years ago. Now, that fact in itself might recommend it as a really authentic bit of Jewish literature, but it's not really germane to Jason's question. One of the more interesting Jewish books I ever read, and which is very instructive in its own unintentional way, is a book by Leo Rosten called The Joys of Yiddish, and it's about their language, a language which, like everything they have or practice, the Jews stole from somebody else. Now, the first interesting aspect of that book is the fact that almost 25% of the words Rosten lists in his lexicon are obscenities, or insults, or terms of abuse and vilification, not just against Gentiles, but against other Jews. Now, one thing that you will find out if you get into Jewish history and culture even a little bit is that not only do they hate the Goyim, but they really don't like each other much. And in fact, they spend almost as much time reviling and attacking and undercutting and slandering each other as they do the Gentiles, which really makes the fact that they are capable of showing such unity in the face of an outside threat all the more remarkable. Now, you see this all the time in Israeli newspapers, when their Haredi or ultra-Orthodox Jews start to physically stone other Jews on the streets of Jerusalem or wherever. But another interesting aspect of Rosten's book is not so much all the Yiddish words, but the stories that accompany them. Now, I've always found Jewish folklore and culture and humor fascinating, because that's where you learn about a people, much more so than mere dry facts and figures in a history book or in political polemics or whatever. There is, for example, the romance of Jewish names. Up until the 17th century, Jews didn't use last names. It would be Aaron of Frankfurt, or Baruch of Chelm, or Shlomo the pawnbroker, or Isaac ben Jacob the Scheisberger rabbi, or whatever. The Jews used this lack of surnames as a way to avoid the authorities making any accurate count of their numbers, and to avoid legal identification, and to avoid taxes and legal obligations, so forth and so on, since no one was ever quite sure which Jew was which and which Jew belonged where. But finally, in the 17th century, one of the Holy Roman Emperors put his foot down and ordered that all the Jews in his realm, which at that time included large parts of Germany and Poland and Eastern Europe, where there were a lot of Jews, anyway, they all had to pick a surname and be registered for tax and census purposes, and for once, these orders were actually enforced by the bureaucracy, and the Jews had to comply. Now, officially, they were supposed to be assigned names under some system or other the government devised. But if they bribed the census taker, they got to choose their own surnames, and it is fascinating to see what names they chose. A few of them chose names like Adler, which is eagle, or Kaplan, which is actually one of the few Khazar names that survived. And those who were the ancient priestly class from the temple in Jerusalem, of course, called themselves Kohen. Now, some chose poetic names like Morgenthau, which means morning dew. But many, many of these Hebes chose names really revealing of their mindset. Goldberg and Silverberg, meaning mountain of gold and mountain of silver. Goldstein and Silverstein, meaning jewel of gold or jewel of silver. Goldman and Silverman, which is obvious. Goldbaum, tree of gold. Rothstein, meaning red jewel or ruby. And then, of course, there's Rubenstein, which means the same thing. Various names involving gelt for money, like Altgelt and Geltblum, money flower. Perlman and Perlmutter, meaning man of pearl and mother of pearl. The name Rothschild was, I believe, chosen at about this time, meaning red shield, which was a medieval German pawnbroker's sign, which, of course, is how the Rothschilds got their start. But if a Jew didn't bribe the census taker or gave him grief in some way, they would get assigned names that they didn't like by pissed off Gentiles, names like Gansfleisch and Ochsenschwanz, which means goose flesh and ox prick, Pector, which means troublemaker, Feigenbaum, which means the tree of hanged cowards, good stuff like that. It's just really weird how wherever they have lived down through the centuries, everybody from the Russians to the ancient Egyptians to the Romans to medieval English to the French to the Cubans and Manchurians have always reacted the same way to Jews. And they all have the same kind of stories to tell, separated by language and culture and thousands of miles and centuries in time. Now, Jason, you can tell a lot about people from their humor, the kind that they use among themselves, about themselves. Now, some of you may or may not know what the Borscht Belt is, or was. It was also known as the Jewish Alps. It was this string of summer resorts in the Catskills that were exclusively Jewish. There may still be some of that left, but I think it mostly died out in the late 60s or early 70s. The movie Dirty Dancing was about the Borscht Belt. Anyway, they had a number of very famous comedians at these resorts, like Myron Cohen, Rodney Dangerfield, Jackie Mason, and the early Lenny Bruce, who would do their routines in Yiddish because they knew that everybody in the audience could understand them. I'm going to do something now that I don't normally do. I'm going to tell a couple of Jew jokes. I don't normally do that because I don't think they're funny or an apt subject for humor any more than the bubonic plague bacillus would be. But, like I said, you can tell an awful lot about people from what they think is funny. I bear in mind, again, that these are Borscht Belt jokes that were originally told to audiences of rich or upper-middle-class Jews at a time in which they were politically and culturally ascendant, and their position at the top of American society was unquestioned. They were as rich and powerful and secure as they have ever been, and probably ever will be. These jokes were originally told in Yiddish, and so they may lose something in the translation, but here goes. First joke. Around the middle of the 19th century, the famous Austrian explorer Baron Esterhazy was planning an expedition across deepest, darkest Asia to the mysterious land of Mongolia, and he took out an advertisement in the newspapers in Vienna. Wanted: traveling companion for a long and dangerous expedition to unknown lands. Successful applicant must be a superb horseman, a crack shot, a master swordsman, and speak at least 4 major Oriental languages. So, a few days later, the Baron comes home to his mansion, and he finds this little Jew in a yarmulke sitting in his vestibule waiting for him. "Who are you?" he asks. "I'm here about your advertisement," said the little Jew. Well, this guy was a skinny, pale little runt, and he certainly didn't look like an explorer, but Esterhazy said, "Well, okay. Are you a superb horseman?" "Who, me?" says the Jew. "Certainly not. I'm afraid of horses." "Are you an expert marksman?" "Don't be silly. I never fired a gun in my life." "Well, are you a master swordsman?" "You're kidding. What should I do with a sword?" "Do you speak any Oriental languages?" "Me? I speak only Yiddish." And the Baron loses his temper and shouts at him, "If you don't have any of the qualifications I asked for in the advertisement, then why the devil are you here?" And the little Jew says, "I've just come to tell you that on me you shouldn't depend." Okay, bear with me. I assure you all this does have a point. Second joke. A Polish businessman is taking a trip on a train from Warsaw to Krakow. Polish trains at the time weren't exactly luxurious. There were no compartments on this train, so everyone sat on benches facing one another, like you see in Western movies, I guess. At the rear of the passenger coach was a barrel of water and a dipper that people could drink from if they got thirsty. Now, the Polish businessman was seated across from an old Jew in full Hasidic get-up, and as the train rolled down the track and he tried to read his Warsaw Times or whatever it was, the old Jew started to whine and complain, or kvetch, as they call it in Yiddish. I'm so thirsty. Such a thirst I'm feeling. Gewalt, am I ever so thirsty? And this went on and on and on for mile after mile. I'm so thirsty. I'm dying of thirst. Okay, finally the Pole throws down his newspaper and says, all right then. He gets up and he goes to the back of the coach, dips out some water and brings the dipper back to the old Jew, who drinks it down. Then he takes the dipper back, puts it back on a hook, and then he comes back to his seat and picks up his newspaper again. And for a few minutes, there was silence. And then the old Jew starts up again. I was so thirsty. Was I ever thirsty. Now, I understand that both of those, when told in Yiddish at these clubs in the Catskills, would have the audience rolling on the floor. But think about this. This is what Jews consider to be hysterically funny. One of their own tribe being completely obnoxious and annoying the hell out of one of us for no reason other than to be a dick, or a putz, as they would say, inserting themselves into some non-Jewish life purely to cause tzimis, trouble, uproar, just for its own sake. There you have the Jewish mind, Jason, or one aspect of it. Now we got some more evil karaoke for you.
See you back. But goodbye, friend. and ask your clip. Too bad you can't carry a whip.
You know, it strikes me that some of you out there, especially among our new listeners, have never heard the late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell speak. This is taken from one of his 1967 college campus speeches, I think Brown University.
I'm going to show you how far these people go in screwing you, and you don't know anything about it. You're not allowed to know it, but I want to show you what they're doing to you as you sit here today. The money that they're taking out of your pocket with the utmost arrogance, and they got you all putting your little Jewish stars on to show how you love them. Well, now let me see how long you want to keep paying them for doing this. Here is a cover of a directory called Kosher Products Directory. There's a big U here in a circle. Well, now you may think we're talking about matzo balls and gefilte fish. We're not. This is a directory, ladies and gentlemen, of grocery supplies that you can find all over your grocery shelves, like Ajax Cleanser, for instance, or all sorts of a sack of coffee, almost any kind of food that you can think of. When you get out of here, go home and look on your grocery shelf, and you will find about one out of three cans and bottles. Somewhere buried away is this little U or a K. The R means registered and the C means copyright, but the K means kosher, and the U means Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations. The U and the K, ladies and gentlemen, mean that you have paid a rabbi to bless this chow in order to make it kosher.
Those of us who have had the misfortune of having undergone an education, so-called, in one of the modern universities or even high schools in our glorious mosaic, have at one time or another been forced to sit through one of these long, turgid, dramatized documentaries, so-called, about the horrors of slavery. Well, never let it be said that we're not politically correct on this show. So now we're going to hear about the horrors of the slave trade. The trouble is, this one will be the actual historical story of the slave trade. This is by a group or individual calling themselves White Education, EDGE-ucation.
The story of the slaves in America begins with Christopher Columbus. His voyage to America was not financed by Queen Isabella, but by Louis de Santiago, who advanced the sum of 17,000 ducats, about 5,000 pounds today, equal to 50,000 pounds, to finance the voyage, which began on August 3rd, 1492. Columbus was accompanied by five Marranos, Jews who had forsworn their religion and supposedly became Catholics. Luis de Torre, interpreter, Marco, the surgeon, Bamal, the physician, Alonso de la Calle, and Gabriel Sanchez. The reference is The International Jew by Henry Ford. Gabriel Sanchez, abetted by the other four Jews, sold Columbus on the idea of capturing 500 Indians and selling them as slaves in Seville, Spain, which was done. Columbus did not receive any of the money from the sale of the slaves, but he became the victim of a conspiracy fostered by Bamal, the ship's doctor. He, Columbus, suffered injustice and imprisonment as his reward, betrayed by the five Marranos, or Jews, whom he had trusted and helped. This, ironically, was the beginning of slavery in the Americas. The source is Adventures of an African Slaver, published in 1928, page 11. The Jews were expelled from Spain on August 2, 1492, and from Portugal in 1497. Many of these Jews immigrated to Holland, where they set up the Dutch West Indies Company to exploit the New World. In 1654, the first Jew, Jacob Bar Simpson, immigrated from Holland to New Amsterdam, New York. And in the next decade, many more followed him, settling along the East Coast, principally in New Amsterdam and Newport, Rhode Island. They were prevented by ordinances issued by Governor Peter Stuyvesant from engaging in the domestic economy. So they quickly discovered that the territory inhabited by the Indians would be a fertile field. There were no laws preventing the Jews from trading with the Indians. The first Jew to begin trading with the Indians was Hyman Levy, who imported cheap glass beads, textiles, earrings, armbands, and other cheap adornments from Holland, which were traded for valuable fur pelts. Hyman Levy was soon joined by Jews Nicholas Lowe and Joseph Simon. Lowe conceived the idea of trading rum and whiskey to the Indians and set up a distillery in Newport, where these two liquors were produced. Within a short time, there were 22 distilleries in Newport, all of them owned by Jews, manufacturing and distributing fire water. The story of the debauching of the Indians, with its resultant massacres of the early settlers, is a dramatic story in itself. It is essential to comprehend the seaport of Newport. It is important in order to recognize the Jewish share in the slave commerce. There was a period when it was commonly referred to as, quote, the Jewish Newport World Center of Slave Commerce. Altogether at this time, there were, in North America, six Jewish communities: Newport, Charleston, New York, Philadelphia, Richmond, and Savannah. There were also many other Jews scattered over the entire East Coast. Although New York held first place in the settlers of Jews in North America, Newport held second place. New York was also the main source of kosher meat, supplying the North American settlements, then the West Indies, and also South America. Now Newport took over. Newport also became the great trade harbor of the East Coast of North America. There, vessels from other ports met to exchange commodities. Newport, as previously mentioned, represented the foremost place in the commerce of rum, whiskey, and liquor dealings. And to include, it finally became the main center of slave dealings. It was from this port that the ships left on their way across the ocean to gather their black human cargo and then derive great sums of money in exchange for them. An authentic contemporary report based on authority indicates that of 128 slave ships, for instance, unloaded in Charleston within 1 year, their cargo, 120 of these were undersigned by Jews from Newport and Charleston by their own name.
We haven't heard from Brian from Illinois for a while, but he sent in a short clip this week talking about his favorite comic book. And there's something really quintessentially American about that.
My name is General Zod. I come from a world far from yours. I have journeyed across an ocean of stars to reach you.
Greetings, comrades. I just wanted to talk to you about a couple more contemporary items, a little bit lighter fare than what we normally have on Radio Free Northwest. One of which is the 2013 movie Man of Steel about Superman. When I was a kid, I loved Superman. I mean, Superman represented America to me. Red, white, and blue, truth and American way, and all that good stuff. But just like how I have fallen out of love with America, I've fallen out of love with Superman. As you get a little older, sometimes the scales fall from your eyes and you see things for the way they really are. Superman, his creator was Jerry Siegel. He was Jewish. And in the movie, his Kryptonian name is Kal-El. El is a prefix that is used by the Hebrews. And there's also the correlation of Superman is placed in that little space pod and fired out towards planet Earth. That's a lot like the Egyptians putting Moses in the basket and setting him on the River Nile. Then there is the way that Superman behaves as an adult. Superman is the ultimate cuckservative. And I'm using the Urban Dictionary definition of cuckservative as someone who will sell out and undermine his home country's people, culture, and national interest in order to win the approval with parties hostile or indifferent to them. And in Man of Steel, you see that General Zod comes to Kal-El and asks him to help him save the Kryptonian race, and Superman basically exterminates his own people. But he gets to get a kiss from the pretty redhead, so that makes it all worth it. So, in having come to despise my childhood hero of Superman, I have a new hero now in General Zod. This is a guy who understands the leadership principle. He's a nationalist. He sees what he has to do, and he does it. It may be hard, but he does it. And there's a quote in there where he's talking to Clark, and he says, "No matter how violent, every action I take is for the greater good of my people." Man, when I heard that, I was like, hell yeah, that's right.
Don't care much about crypto heat. Don't know much about usury. Don't care much about lying crooks. Don't know much about the Talmud books. But I do know that I hate Jews. And I know that if you did too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about killing bees. Don't know much about Cyclone B. Don't know how many the ovens cook. Don't know how the gas chambers work. But once you learn that it isn't true, you won't believe a word a guy tells you. What a wonderful world this will be. Now, I don't claim to be an anti-Semite, but I'm trying to be. And maybe by being an anti-Semite baby, I can turn you into a Nazi. Don't care much about crypto heaps. Don't know much about usury. Don't care much about lying crooks. Don't know much about the Talmud books. But I do know that I hate Jews. And I know that if you did too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about killing bees. Don't know much about Cyclone B. Don't know how many the ovens cooked. Don't know how the gas chambers worked. But once you learn that it isn't true, you won't believe a word a guy tells you. What a wonderful world this will be.
We got a lot of short stuff this week. This is something from Maura Keogh, that guy who does the Agreeing with Liberals for the Wrong Reasons series. I'm not sure whether Maura Keogh himself does both these and the Evil Karaoke as well, or whether that's a kind of generic name for a group of guys and girls. Sounds to me like that might be the case, because listening to all this stuff, it sounds to me like there's more than one person involved. Whoever they are, I wish to hell someone would point them in the direction of northwestfront.org. Now, I have some comments about this young man's presentation, and I'm not sure whether I should make them before or after his brief little speech here. You may have noticed that quite often I have to kind of hedge or qualify some of these audio cuts I play on here with stuff that is mildly critical, or dilute it a little with disclaimers due to some potentially problematic aspect of the content or the presentation which doesn't quite come up to snuff. And I really hate doing that, because it sounds like I'm nitpicking and an old man crabbing at young talent and all that, and that's not what I mean to do and not how I want to come off. So let me make it clear right now that I am extremely impressed with these Maura Keogh cuts. I am impressed by the level of intelligence and genuine wit, which is something you don't often find among us, and with the technical expertise of the people involved, and I want him or them to keep it up and get millions of viewers on these YouTube videos. I think I'll go ahead and let him have his say, and then I'll have mine.
Agreeing with Liberals for the Wrong Reasons, Episode 12, Diversity Training. There are some people on the left who think diversity training is counterproductive, and you've got your social justice warriors who might think it doesn't go far enough, or the diversity training they went to was conducted by some shitlord.
He didn't use my pronouns correctly!
There's a lot of social justice warrior rent-seeking involved in this, but I think it's a pretty mainstream thing by how pervasive diversity training is in corporate world. It seems like a pretty run-of-the-mill liberal thing at this point. These people believe in an extremely low heritability for IQ, so they think education is the key to everything, and we're all blank slates, so we can just reshape that and educate away the racism, so that's where the diversity training comes from. But in reality, it kind of has the opposite effect, and that's why a conservative or a reactionary or Nazi or whatever would agree with liberals for the wrong reasons. Most diversity training, ineffective study finds, a comprehensive review of 31 years of data from 830 mid-sized to large U.S. workplaces found that the kind of diversity training exercises offered at most firms were followed by a 7.5% drop in the number of women in management. The number of black female managers fell by 10%, and the number of black men in top positions fell by 12%. Similar effects were seen for Latinos and Asians. The analysis did not find that all diversity training is useless. Rather, it showed that mandatory programs, often undertaken mainly with an eye to avoiding liability and discrimination lawsuits, were the problem. When diversity training is voluntary and undertaken to advance a company's business goals, it was associated with increased diversity in management. So what you want to do is really shove it down people's throats. I mean, if you have to legislate this at the federal level and force every company with more than 50 employees or whatever to get diversity training, that would be golden. I mean, sure, we'd be funding, it'd be like a welfare program for Anita Sarkeesian. No. You want someone even more abrasive. You want Big Red to call your employees fuckfaces and tell them how patriarchal and racist they are. All of your employees who maybe previously would have said, I don't see race, I'm colorblind, and maybe they've never done anything to anyone on the basis of race, they just don't give a shit. You want them to be filled with hatred all of a sudden because someone is calling them the scum of the earth and a vile piece of shit for something they didn't even do. So I don't think it would be too difficult to ram this through white America's collective sphincter at the federal level. I mean, liberals are pretty receptive to this shit. If you don't bake a cake for the gay wedding, you're gonna get sued and lose your business. So right-wingers should start fomenting this crap with the liberals. I mean, they're probably going to do it anyway, but might as well push it along faster since it has such disastrous effects for their agenda.
Okay, as you may have guessed, my qualification here has to do with this young man's language. I won't even say foul language because among anyone born after 1970, it mostly isn't even considered foul anymore. There is so much of this casual profanity and obscenity out there that it has lost most of its impact because it's just what we're used to hearing in a society that has become largely niggerized. Now that's exactly where we got it, from being around niggers all the time, either personally or through the media. Niggers corrupt and degrade everything they touch, including the language. The use and overuse of these words, until they have crept into white people's speech patterns and are now accepted as normal, is yet another wrong that these creatures and the Jewish system that promotes them have done to us. As the saying goes, it's like mixing shit with ice cream. There, you see, I just did it too, almost reflexively, because in this era, that is just how most white people talk. We picked it up from the blacks, and what remains of our own culture no longer has the strength or the purpose or the will to tell us it's wrong and use social disapproval to make us stop and clean up our act. It's not considered foul language anymore except by those of my generation, the last generation raised in the old ways. I never heard it used as common speech myself until I went into the Army in 1971, and for the first time I was around proper urban niggers. Even those southern coons that I had just spent the past 3 years with in high school still mostly came from traditional two-parent families, and they had black elders who made them watch their language. And yes, I know, I myself use these words on occasion for emphasis as a kind of colloquialism or to try and put myself on a credible basis of communication with younger white people, to whom these words are simply part of their everyday speech. As indeed I just did. The difference is that I know it's wrong, and I use it deliberately so as not to talk to my own people like I'm speaking to them through a time warp from the year 1920 or something of the kind. They wouldn't get that. They would think it was quaint. When one is speaking to an audience of Frenchmen, one needs to speak French in order to be understood. I just try not to overdo it. I'm not going to belabor this point too much more, but I just thought I'd mention it for the benefit of those of you nearer my age who still get that jarring feeling when we hear these words coming out of young white people's mouths all the time. This is just another line item we can add to the Jews' long and heavy bill, which we will present for payment on that glorious future day when, through some miracle, we recover our ancient moral fiber and become brave again.
Westbound and down, 18 wheels are rolling. Are we gonna do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we gotta run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Illinois. I just delivered yesterday, July 3rd, in the safest state in the nation. The reason I say that is because, oh, it has to be the safest state in the nation. It's got one of the, according to the Brady campaign and all the rest of them, idiots and the every town for gun safety. I mean, you can't even get a gun. You have to beg for permission to buy a gun in the state of New Jersey. You can't have hollow point ammunition in the state of New Jersey, or at least carry it, transport it, or whatever. I guess you can have it at home. But anyway, yeah, I'm just going on a little rant there because I hate having to go and do deliveries in there. I'm glad to be out of there. Be back in freer states. Not that Illinois is the greatest, but hey, it's getting better. Not that we have the perfect gun laws and stuff out there in the Pacific Northwest, but hey, they're a lot better than most other places. But anyway, so I've been listening to Ann Coulter's book. Just got it here the other day, Adios America, about turning the country into a third world hellhole. And I challenge every one of you that listen to this podcast to go and get the book, either in audio format like I've got it, because I can listen to it going down the road and stuff, or get it on Kindle, get it in paperback, Dead Tree, whatever. and go through that book and then ask yourself why the hell you are still living where you are. The place I picked up there in southeastern Pennsylvania, the cold storage warehouse, I saw one white guy that actually spoke English there. All the office gals there that were checking drivers in and stuff were all chattering away in their damn Spanish or whatever the hell language they were talking in and stuff. A couple of them were real rude and stuff and didn't really want to have to deal with it, us truck drivers and stuff, but oh well, guys out there on the dock, they were chattering away in Spanish, and it's one of those, nothing pisses me off more than having to go and do business with places that don't have people that, I mean, yeah, the office gals were bilingual, they actually spoke English, but in between them, they were chattering away in Spanish or Mexicala or whatever the hell language they used. You know, it's just irritating as hell. If you're going to come to this damn country, learn the damn language. I'm getting sick of that kind of stuff, but anyway. So, I should be out there in the homeland here this next week for a little bit of home time and stuff, so yeah, who knows, I might even end up being able to touch base with some of the comrades out there. I guess it's our get together out there sometime here soon, so maybe I'll be home for it. But yeah, I know there's your part of the country you think is great and all that, but really need to listen to Harold and Andy and come out here on your scouting trip and then make your move. Because it's that idiot damn Kenyon in the White House is really screwing things up more and more and more. So if you wait too long, it might be too late and you might not ever make it out here. So please choose wisely, do your scouting trip, and then pack your assets and come on out here to the Northwest. All right, this is the Trucker signing off for another edition from On the Road. Talk to you later, comrades.
This is Ralph Stanley.
Well, yonder stands little Maggie with a jam glass in her hand. She's drinking away her trouble, transporting another man. We'll be right back.
Some of you may wonder why I haven't said anything about the overrunning of Northern Europe by all those so-called refugees, mostly from Syria but also from Africa. An overrunning which began many months ago before the media decided to pay any attention to it. Remember all that mess in and around the Calais Channel Tunnel with the thousands of wogs and niggers trying to storm the tunnel and get into Britain? I'm not sure that anything needs to be said. Really, what could any comment of mine on this tiny little podcast possibly do to clarify or improve the situation? What can I possibly add to the destruction of an entire culture and its homeland? It only proves that one way or another, doomsdays do eventually come. There comes a time when the bill finally has to be paid, and that moment is happening for Europe right now. Within another generation, any trace of our ancestral European homeland is going to be gone. There is a price to be paid for ignoring politics and civic duty in order to live for oneself. There is a price to be paid for tolerating the corruption of liberal democracy in the name of a welfare state or material wealth. There is a price to be paid for cowardice and foolishness and the refusal to take a weapon into one's hand and fight for life. And the remaining white people of Europe are paying that now. Those who do not fight will die. And it looks like the white people of Europe are going to die. A very small number of them are marching in the streets holding signs and chanting slogans, when they should be physically opposing the incoming invaders with their bodies and any weapon that comes to hand in their societies, which they have so foolishly allowed to be stripped of guns. They are threatening to vote for a few mildly right-wing European parties and their weak and insipid leaders, who mouth a few anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim mumblings, but who have been completely co-opted and compromised through what is known as movement modernization into accepting and practicing buggery and philo-Semitism. They persist in trying to use democracy to solve the very problem that democracy has created, which is like trying to put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it. I've heard all the conspiracy theories about this whole thing being a setup by ISIS or George Soros, and there may be something to that, I don't know. All I know is that everybody and his dog knew that this was coming, and saying I told you so doesn't do a damn bit of good. The white people of Europe have reached the point where they must fight, not with computer keyboards, but with weapons in their hands, as we in North America will reach that point sooner than we think. The people of Europe are almost certainly not going to do so, and most likely neither will we. The result is that both the shattered remnants of white Europe and then the shattered remnants of white America will in turn become refugees, fleeing before the waves of invaders. You and your family will almost certainly become part of that next wave of refugees. I know you don't believe that, but it doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter whether or not you believe in the ocean. If you fall into it, you're going to get wet. We need to make sure that there is some place for them to flee to. A sovereign white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.